You know, might as well start now. Because I'm contemplating just sitting here, I came in early, that a lot of times in our life that we're sitting, waiting for something to happen. We've arrived, but the bus hasn't left. We're sitting, but the aircraft hasn't taken off. And it's something which I call the in-between moments of life.
Very good. Excellent.
And in those in-between moments of life, we live most of our time there. Waiting for something to start, waiting for something to finish. And often we waste those times. But I really love those times, the in-between moments of life. It's a time when you can relax and just be here. Because you've arrived at your seat, but the aircraft hasn't left. So there's beautiful moments of just being here. Struggle and striving has finished for the time being. You don't have to do anything. I recall just against my recommendations, a person just asked me to please let me drive you in their car from one part of London to another part of London to give a talk. And I know London, I'll go up there. And it's even worse these days, there's traffic jams all over the place. I said, let's get in an underground train. He said, no, you can't get in an underground train. And we have my car. My car needs to make merit so I can get reborn as a Ferrari in its next incarnation. And so, so they refused to let me go on the underground train. So instead of a journey taking about 40 minutes, it took about 2.5 hours. Stuck in traffic jams. But then the driver was getting more and more upset. And I said, oh, it's okay, you can't do anything. You're stuck in a traffic jam. Shouting at that traffic, or just trying to weave in and out, and taking shortcuts are the worst. Never ever take a shortcut. It always takes much longer. That's my experience anyway. Just coming back from, it was in Sri Lanka, I was visiting Sri Lanka, and visiting Kandy, giving a talk there. And a gentleman who was taking me back from Kandy to Colombo. It's only an hour's drive. But he decided to take shortcuts. And it took about 3 or 4 hours. And all my hosts thought I'd been kidnapped or something. So anyway, and he was a local, he should have known better, but he got totally lost doing shortcuts. So never do shortcuts. But anyway, why do a shortcut anyway? You're in a traffic jam. You can't go forward, you can't go back, you're just where you are. What a great Dhamma teaching that is. So you're just there. You're totally out of control. Even a driver can't make it go faster, or maybe he can make it go slower, but he can't make it go faster. So you learn how just to relax to the max and just be here. And enjoy this moment. And people ask me, say, well, aren't you worried that you're going to miss your talk? And nah, they know all my stories anyway. And I said, I could just relax and meditate instead of just rushing around all over the place. So I kind of like these in-between moments of life, which instead of we try to get rid of, so we can go and get something else or be somewhere else, in those in-between moments of life, I really enjoy. Because in the in-between moments of life, there's so much beauty and rest to be found. So instead of reading a book, you know, if you're waiting for an aircraft, oh, with one exception, if it's my book. Only joking. So instead of reading a book or wasting time, I can actually be here and enjoy this moment. And thereby, you are practicing a very profound aspect of meditation. Learning how to be here. And enjoying the beauty of being here. Rather than thinking that all your happiness solutions to your problems are found somewhere else. In the next stop, the next destination, next experience. No. See if you can find peace, meaning, happiness, joy. Right now. Where you're sitting. With what you've got. This is the Four Noble Truths as taught by the Buddha. In brief. When you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. That's actually all the Dhamma teachings you really need to become enlightened. When you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. So what more do you want right now? You give me a list. You give me a list. This is what happened to me. you know, most of my stories, but I'm just hoping that you've forgotten them by now. Because many of you are getting old. As a monk, you know, Ajahn Chah's teachings is very strict, and thank goodness that, you know, he was keeping these rules and made sure we kept those rules as well, so that no one could give us any money. They tried many times. You know, just, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you really helped me. This is not for the monastery, this is not for the temple, it's for you. What? And so I said, sorry, I can't accept it, because I'm a monk. So there is a loophole. Like everything, there's always loopholes. And the loophole is, it's called the mendicant allowance. What you can do is you can say, Ajahn Brahm, you really helped me. Now, I know I can't give you any money, but I can maybe sort of give it to Christina. But it's not for the Jhana Grove, it's for you. So if anything you need, just go and tell Christina, the caretaker, and she will get it for you. So, you know, that's using like an attendant. And this fellow said, and usually you actually specify the amount. So this fellow said, I was only a young monk at the time, he said, oh, you really helped me. Can I, you know, I'm going to leave some money with the, first of all he said, what can I get you for 100 baht? And that you may think that's not much money these days, but that day, for a monk who's got nothing, that was really a fortune. What do you want for 100 baht? And I thought, and I contemplated, and I considered, and I couldn't think. Because it really sort of came sort of unexpectedly. And so he was getting agitated, he had to go back to work, and so I came up with an idea. He said, you come back at the same time tomorrow, and I'll give you a list of the things I need for 100 baht. Good idea, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow, sadhu. And he went off to work. And that night, I sat in my kuti, this was in Thailand, and I thought, what do I need for 100 baht? And straight away, you know, I was writing this, it's no exaggeration, on the back of a mosquito coil wrapper. I didn't have any paper. So I thought, well, that's a reasonable thing for a monk, just to have some exercise paper. You know, some light exercise paper. Simple, very cheap. But I was also writing with a pencil. And the pencil was getting very, very small. So I said, well, just a simple, like, you know, biro bit pen or something. Ballpoint. So that's my second thing on the list. And the third thing, well, you know, I was writing this by candlelight. It's really bad for your eyes. I didn't want a sort of a electricity supply to my heart, but just one of these little kerosene lanterns. So that's my third thing. And then with kerosene lanterns, actually you just need some matches to actually to light it. And then I thought, well, because, you know, it's very dark in this forest and there's snakes around, maybe I should get a flashlight too. And after a flashlight, you know, I need some batteries for them as well. And when I'm walking, because my shoes were really, really just, they were tied together by string, literally. I said, I had better get a new pair of thongs. And then I started tallying up, and it was much more than 100 baht. And I couldn't take anything off the list. Everything I had on the list was now really important. I don't know how I live without it. And then when I sort of started thinking what to take off, I added more things. And the list got longer and longer and longer, and I couldn't take anything off, and it was 1,000 baht, 10,000 baht. And that is when I saw what was going on. Once a little crack of wanting had come in to my mind, it opened up this whole mass of things which I really needed. I didn't need them, I just wanted them. And so I took that piece of paper and I threw it in the bin. And the next day, I told that fellow, 100 baht, you can give it to the church, or you can put it in the fire, as far as I'm concerned, but please don't ever do that to me again. I was such a happy monk before I had 100 baht to spend. Can you understand what we mean there? It's never enough. Oh, that lovely story of the, nothing to do with putting down nuns, but this was this nun, long time ago, Bhikkhuni, who lived in a cave. Really simple. And she would go on alms round every morning and just get whatever food she wanted, needed, and she'd spend the rest of the day meditating in the cave or teaching meditation or Dhamma to any villager who happened to pass by. Very peaceful, happy life. But she had one problem, that when she went for alms round, this mouse would take advantage of her kindness, would crawl into her cave and chew some of her robes. So every day when she came back from alms round, she saw another hole in one of her spare robes by the mouse. And so, you got compassion, may all mice be happy and well. It's only a tiny bit of her robe, but when you have to keep putting the patch on, day after day after day, she was putting the patches on her robe again when she said, I could be studying some Dhamma or meditating or something, instead of sewing up these patches every day because that silly mouse. And then she had an idea, an insight came. If I had a cat, then the mouse wouldn't be here and I wouldn't need to spend all the time fixing up my robes. And so the next day, when she was in alms round in the village, she asked one of the villagers, she saw the cat had a lot of kittens. You know, when you have lots of kittens, you're so happy to get rid of those kittens, to give it a good home. What better home can you get than letting one of the nuns have a little kitten? And the nun thought, yeah, please, can I have that kitten? Because, I would look after it, and the kitten would actually keep the mouse away. So she had a kitten to keep the mouse away, so she didn't have to keep mending her robes. But then, kittens, they don't eat rice and curry. They need milk. So the next day, when she went into the village, she asked the villagers, can I have some milk as well to feed the kitten? Now getting to be a cat. To keep the mouse away, so I don't need to sew my robe, so I could have more peace and quiet. So yeah, they gave every day, then they gave a little bit of milk. But then, it was such a burden carrying the milk back to the cave. So she thought, I'm really harassing these villagers. So instead of just asking for some milk every day, it's coming on to one of the big ceremony days, why don't I say, can we have a fundraiser to raise money so I can buy myself a cow? Because if I have a cow, then I'll be able to milk the cow myself, so I don't need to ask anybody else to get the milk. It's much more convenient. And then I have the milk to feed the kit cat, to keep the mouse away, so I wouldn't need to mend my robe. And so, the big ceremony came, and they raised enough money to buy her a cow. And so she never needed to ask for milk anymore, she just milked the cow to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away. And then she thought, the cow is really making a mess. Oh no, first of all, the cow needed something to eat itself. So every day, I had to ask the villagers for some hay. To feed the cow, to provide the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away, so she didn't need to mend her robes. Then, okay. But then, getting the hay from the villagers was just like asking for milk again. So, even the villagers said, this is really sort of a hassle for us. Why don't we offer you a field? So, they offered the bhikkhuni a field, a tiny bit of land, so she could graze her cow to get the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away, so she didn't need to spend time sewing her robes. And then, it was such a hassle just actually to go every time to get the milk from the cow to make sure it was all locked up and the fences were in good repair. So she said, oh, maybe I can have, you know, one of the boys from the village. Sometimes these boys are very naughty and they just need a good person, like a really good nun, to look after them, to teach them to Dhamma, to keep them in line. And of course there was lots of her supporters were more than too willing to loan her one of the naughty boys in their household. And so she got the boy to look after the cow, to get the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away, so she didn't need to waste time sewing her robes. I think you all know where this is going if you haven't heard it before. But if you've got a boy, boy can't stay in a cave together with a nun. So I had to build the boy a little hut just outside the cave. So she asked the villagers for wood and for a carpenter to make a nice hut for the boy to look up. And then she started thinking. Oh no, this is not yet, sorry. Then she was going into the village, you know, to do all the plans, you know, for the hut. When a villager stopped her and said, oh, I just want to, my meditation's a bit sort of, some problems. Can you please give me some advice on my meditation? And the nun said, I'm sorry, but I've got to go into the village to get some more wood to build the hut for the house, the boy, to look after the cow in my field, to get the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away, so I don't need to keep mending my robe. And then she started thinking, hey, something's going wrong. Before, I'd only spend about half an hour every day mending my robe. Now I'm spending all day on all this stuff. So she realized her mistake. She'd lost her simplicity because she was thinking about convenience. So she sent the boy home, gave all the planks of wood away, gave the cow away, just sold the field, or gave it away, and gave the cat to a nice good home. And then she was back to where she started. In the morning, with nothing, she just went on arms round, got some rice and some food, and when she came home into her cave, she ate her meal, and then saw the mouse had come back, so she very happily just sewed a little patch on her robe again. And that was the end of the story. And I kind of like that idea of just sometimes what are we doing all this for? It keeps some simplicity. Yeah, it's convenient, but keep it simple. Especially if you're a monk or a nun, you're trying to do these simple things. But anyway, that's where when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. And that's what I often do when I'm meditating. Sit down, close my eyes. Sometimes I use that almost like a mantra. What do I want? And I've been around a long time, so I get that, then what? So I say, no, I don't want anything. This is good enough for me. You know, when you don't want anything, okay, you know, later on when you sort of go back to work or, you know, you go doing your duties and responsibilities, when you're just washing the dishes or doing your chores or cutting up the vegetables, you know, you do it properly, you don't think, vegetables, no. I don't want to cut up the vegetables. People don't want to eat. If they really want them, then that's delusion, that's suffering. So you just sit there. It's supposed to be your job, but you don't do it. That's not meditation, that's not wisdom. That's just stupidity and laziness. But what I'm talking about is when you are actually meditating, sitting down or walking, what do you want? And sometimes I often notice whenever the meditation does not flow smoothly, it's always somewhere, and I want something. I want to get rid of something. And as soon as I notice that, I'm wise enough now, experienced enough now, I just zap it. Because when I want something, I can't enjoy this moment, just being here. I may not be full of energy, still got some jet lag. May not be the fittest monk, you know, getting old. May not be the most wonderful retreat center, but it's good enough. But when I want something more, that's when I suffer. When I'm happy with what I've got, that's when I'm free. Otherwise known as the second and third noble truths. Which is one of the reasons why, for those people who remember their Buddhist teachings, there are two types of meditation. And sometimes, people who don't know me, I ask them, what are those two types of meditation taught by the Buddha? And some people who don't know me put their hand up and say, Samatha Vipassana. Never answer a question in public that I ask, because it's always a trick question. I'm a very sneaky monk. And this particular case, it's not Samatha Vipassana I'm meaning, it's Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. Getting the core teachings of Buddhism and putting them together in meditation. Meditation's not something separate from Buddhist teachings. So what is the Second Noble Truth? Wanting leads to suffering. Third Noble Truth, letting go leads to happiness, to Nibbana. So, when you're meditating, do you want to be happy or do you want to suffer? If you want something, you're going to suffer. So said the Buddha. I rest my case. And if you let go, you won't have suffering. It leads to peace, to enlightenment. Strange. Because everything which you've ever done in this world so far, probably, you've achieved it through wanting, through striving, through effort, and through sacrifice as well. And well done, you've just got such a lot in this world. But in meditation, we're going in a different direction. All that which we've achieved, which we've got, we enjoy it. Instead of trying to get rid of it or trying to make it better or bigger, we learn how to be instead of improving. So this is where, oh, I can't resist the self-improvement joke. Actually, somebody repeated this to me when San Francisco. They just pinched my joke. About the person who went into the bookshop. And the man went into the bookshop and asked the receptionist, could you please tell me where the self-help section is? And the receptionist said, if I told you, sir, it would defeat the purpose. Self-help, find out for yourself. So anyway, when you want something more, you can't enjoy this moment. And meditation gets stuck. When you're happy to be here, enjoying this moment, you become still. You'll be in a traffic jam. In between things, but you're happy to be in between. You're here and enjoying it. When you want something more, of course you can't enjoy it. Because your mind is off into the future. Some fantasy, you think, when I get this, it'll be much better. Or you're off in the past. Oh, the good old days. When I was a young monk, oh, that's when we had real monks, when we were under. No cushions for us. No air conditioners. We were out there in the jungles getting bitten by these mosquitoes, sitting 2 hours, 3 hours a day on a ball of sticky rice and frog soup. Yeah, I would have done that if those days. Of course, you know, sometimes that's what you remember. But it's also a lot of fun as well, a lot of joy. It wasn't totally just all bad. It's still so simple. It's very nice those days. Anyway, back we go to when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. With that, what that means in meditation, you get yourself comfortable as possible, but it will always be a little bit too cold, a little bit too hot. Who's in charge of the air conditioner? Is that Della? That's what you do. You don't actually change the temperature. Do you accept bribes? God, please, God, please. God, God. No, you don't do stuff like that. But I'm sure some people would consider that. How much for an extra couple of degrees? But you can see when you want something more, but sometimes it's a little bit too cold, a little bit too hot. It starts off cold and it gets hot, and sometimes it's too long, it's too short. Sometimes the cushion is too hard, sometimes it's too... I often thought when I went to sort of all places, Berkeley in California, Mountain View, the high-tech capital of the world, Silicon Valley, a lot of them are Buddhists and meditate. Can't they get a high-tech meditation cushion? Imagine the possibilities. You know, it's just got maybe four or five compartments, and you know, with like a remote control, you can press this, and that this compartment inflates, so your knee goes up if it's just getting a two. And I've seen these chairs where you have like massage, so you press another button and your bottom massages. It's a bit too sore. It's a bit too cold. You get like warm air comes up through your body. Too hot, and this beautiful little fan comes out. And if you have sloth and torpor, no sleepiness, you press another little button and you get like a latte or a flat white or a cappuccino. You press which one you want. So sometimes I look at that and, you know, when I should be meditating, I start fantasizing and say, now what type of meditation cushion should I? Should I like? But you'd never get it good enough. And so this is good enough. I'm happy to be with this little cushion, whatever I get. What that means is you learn contentment. Easily satisfied. In fact, some joy in contentment as well. When you're happy to be here, stressing the happiness to be here, who would want to go anywhere? And after a few days in this place, most people, they come and sit here and said, I don't want to go home. It's peaceful here. Okay, you know, I don't eat as much as I would like, and I cannot go to restaurants and get this food and that food. Yeah, the beds, you know, they're okay, but they're not just luxurious. And sometimes you run out of hot water and whatever, but there's something about peace and simplicity, which is so beautiful. And so soon you become very happy to be here. And when you're happy to be here, just have a cup of tea whenever you like. As I say, just watch the trees grow. Just not doing anything. The fact that you can do nothing and be praised for doing nothing and not be considered to be lazy. It's a beautiful thing where relaxation, rest, peace is regarded as wonderful and commendable. I saw this cartoon which people showed me all these wonderful, funny cartoons. And these two monks and the abbot is complimenting the junior monk. So I've come here to compliment you of being so thoughtless. Because being thoughtless, we think that, you know, we're just selfish and inconsiderate. But without thought, the most thoughtless monk in the monastery, in other words, you're peaceful. Okay, that didn't go out very well, but nevertheless, I keep on trying. It's the Buddhist monk's joke. Or just... No, I won't go there. So, when one is content and easily satisfied, one doesn't need to think. Where do your thoughts come from anyway? When I was a young monk, many of you might remember these teachings. You were told, just watch your breath. Okay, watch your breath, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. How long can you do that for? Maybe three or four breaths, if you're honest. And then your mind goes wandering over here, wandering over there, and you're told, bring it back again. I remember doing that for 3 or 4 years. It wandered off, bring it back again. 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 Wandered off. And then I thought, this is not working. So then you started to contemplate, why? Why is my mind wandering off? Why do I have to keep bringing it back? So instead of using any type of force or restraint, at last you remembered what your teachers would say, what you read in the books. Use wisdom power. Why did my mind keep wanting to wander off? Who was it trying to run away from? Me. I had a bad relationship with my breath. Come back again. How many times do I have to tell you, breath, you stay here or else? And of course, after a while, your breath throws a tantrum. I realized that's not the way to meditate. Sure, there must be another way, and of course there is. One of the reasons, nice time to introduce teddy bears. This actually one was came from Malaysia, from KL. So this teddy bear, we tried to auction it, but the fellow said, no, it belongs here in Jhana Grove with its friends. And all these other teddy bear friends. So when you meditate, if you hold a teddy bear, straight away you get very soft, safe, pleasant, which means that when you're watching your breath, it's a pleasant thing to watch. You're not doing this to try and train the mind, to discipline the mind, like becoming a US Marine. This is not boot camp, this is bear camp. But anyway, so you hold a teddy bear. People think Ajahn Brahm's really lost it now, he's being childish, meditating with a bear. But you try it and it works. You get a softness, a kindness, where you want to be here. You're happy to be here. And when you watch your breath, it's easy to watch. Because it's got a sense of gentleness and softness and kindness. And you don't want anything, you're happy to be here. And when your breath is like that, you're watching your breath and you're happy just to be peacefully watching your breath go in and go out, and it's delightful, it's happy, then you can meditate for hours. Just happy with your best friend. I was talking with our president on Friday night about sort of insurance things always going up. So what do I want to insure for? You know, they don't take any account of monks' psychic powers in your insurance quote. You don't have to worry about bushfires or anything in this place. Because we have this bushfire plan for monasteries. And my bushfire plan is all the monks, we stand in one line. When the fire comes, 1, 2, 3 monks together. Well, it's worth a try. But they said that they were talking about, well, just spreading risk and working out what that risk is. It's the job of actuaries. These are people who are like mathematicians who work out probabilities. And it just so happens, one of my best friends from Cambridge, he was the top actuary in the whole of Europe. And well, he's retired now, so I don't mind telling this story. When I met him, I made a point of catching up with him in Victoria train station in London as a monk when I went to visit there once. And, you know, his name was Harold, but, you know, his nickname was Flash. And the reason why we nicknamed him Flash was because one of those parties we had at Cambridge as students, he, you know, drank a little bit too much. And when he went to the toilet, he came back out without his trousers. And that was his nickname, Flash Harry. He exposed himself. And he said, look, I'm a very conservative, highly respected, like accountant, basically. So please don't ruin my reputation by what I got up to when I was at Cambridge. And I said, okay, I agree with that, as long as you don't ruin my reputation with what I got up to in Cambridge as a student. Well, I told most people what I got up to anyway, so not ashamed at all. But anyway, Harry, he was, I hadn't seen him for years, maybe about 30 years. And I spent the next 4 hours just chatting together. And even I went to the Dharma just to be fed, and I said, I'm sorry, I just can't give any chanting because I'm talking to my friend. And we went over to the underground, we went to Wimbledon Temple, I was supposed to give a talk. It's only because when I had to really start talking to all the people who come to my talk that I could actually shut up. It was a friend, a close friend. A friend you shared so many memories with. And it was like, you know, just so close together, attracted, happy, enjoying each other's company. I said, that's like me and my breath. And sometimes they don't see each other for a few hours because you've got to go talking or doing stuff. But then, I come back onto my breath, hey, where you been? We become inseparable. Not because I have to, but because we've got this beautiful relationship now, my breath and I. Like my old mate, Harry. He was, oh, it's just so difficult, you know, it's only because I had to give a talk and he had to go and get some dinner. That's who we parted. So this is what happens when you have this kindness towards your meditation object, like your breath. So what you can do, practical teachings, when you are watching your breathing, just don't just watch breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Just give it a bit more emotional content. This breath has been feeding you oxygen without complaint ever since you were born. Have you said thank you to it yet? Gratitude for giving you life. Even when you're sleeping, when you're busy, it's still putting oxygen into your body. And it takes all the waste products out. It's been doing that night and day for I don't know how many years. So sometimes I begin my breath meditation by thinking, thank you, breath. You've done such a lot for me. And just imagine the breath coming in. I'm not quite sure if it's totally true, but it's pretty accurate apparently. That your breath, it brings in oxygen enriched by everything which is green in the world, which photosynthesizes and releases oxygen, turns the carbon dioxide into oxygen. And that's like the gift of nature to you. And when you breathe out your carbon dioxide, that's the food which is required by the leaves and the plants and the bushes and the grasses and the flowers. It connects you to nature. It's almost like it's a cycle which you're part of. So when I imagine it like that, every breath I breathe in is from all that's green. And every breath I breathe out is absorbed by nature. Connects me. And little by little, as I breathe in and breathe out, it's not just ordinary breath. It's life, it's energy, even like health. Sometimes when I'm breathing in, I ask people to breathe in peace. Or if you're sickly, health. Breathe in health. Imagine health, whatever it is. Or, you know, golden light or white light, sort of energized radiation, loving kindness, whatever it is. Breathe that in. You know, with as much imagination as you possibly can, without reality. Breathing in peace, breathing in health. If you're tired and depressed, breathing in energy. However you imagine and visualize energy to be, you breathe it in. And as you breathe out, let go. It's a natural, the exhaling breath is obviously just you letting go of something when you breathe out. So breathe in peace, health, energy. Breathe out, let go. Of cancers, tumors, pains, difficulties, depression, anxiety, breathe that out. Breathing in peace, breathe out, let go. Just imagine what those things are. And when you do stuff like that, your mind does have power. Again, with all my time in Cambridge, that one of the things I used to do was to go and see hypnotists. You know, this is a psychic research society. And I saw this hypnotist, and it really opened up a lot of understanding about the interaction between the mind and the body. Because in this particular experiment, they got a few students to go up. You know, I volunteered, but I was not a good hypnotic subject. But you know, some people are. And they got this student, and they had a piece of wood with a 4-inch nail on the end. And under hypnosis, they convinced this student that that nail had been heated until it was super hot, it was like red hot. And they touched the nail on the student's skin. He screamed in pain. It was only room temperature, it was just hypnotic suggestion it was really hot. He screamed in pain. I could understand that, but what really shocked me, I've never forgotten it, was that a blister came up. A trauma came up, a burn was on his arm. Where did that come from? Because the metal of the nail was just room temperature. But because he believed, under hypnosis, it was red hot, his mind created a wound on his body, a burn mark, a blister. And of course, I started thinking, if you can create a burn with your mind, maybe you can uncreate a burn with your mind. Maybe your mind can create a tumor. Maybe it can shrink a tumor. That was just the implications of that simple experiment, which kind of shocked me. So even now, when, oh, I don't know how many didn't really mean to get into all these experiences of magical cures and stuff which I've seen with my own eyes happening with people doing meditation retreats. But they're always, you know, just so amazing and wonderful to see these and just how people. There was this one guy, it's a retreat over in Sydney, and he was, oh, this is one of many. This fellow was, when he started on the meditation retreat, the first evening there was all these questions. They weren't questions, they were complaints. Can you please ask meditators to breathe quietly? You know, it's a ridiculous question, but that's what it was. Can you please ask them to breathe quietly? Because this gentleman was... all the time. And so I announced to everybody that that gentleman, he didn't want to be singled out, but I had to. I said, that gentleman, he's got this huge tumour in his bridge of his nose. He's got nasal cancer. And his physicians, specialists, have given him only maybe a few weeks or a month to live. And he's just come to this meditation retreat, as he said, a last throw of the dice. Who knows? He wasn't a Buddhist, but who knows? Meditation's got a good reputation, so give it a try. And throughout the whole 9 days, all the time. And then it wasn't working. Meditation didn't work for him. Except the last meditation. And I was already, you know, getting in the car to go to the airport to catch a flight back to Perth. And of course, he came running after me and says, Ajahn Bab, Ajahn Bab, Ajahn Bab, stop. So what happened? And he said, the last meditation, just usual, business as usual. But then he said he heard a pop, popping sound. And he could breathe through his nose. But only for 1 minute, and then it closed up again. But that 1 minute where he could actually breathe through his nose, he hadn't breathed through his nose in weeks or months. And this is not imagination, this was real, he could feel it. Air was going through his nose again. But then it sort of closed up. And I didn't really have much time. I tried to encourage him, yeah, great, keep going, who knows. But when I went back in the car, I thought he left it too late. I never expected him to survive. But of course, what happened next, and the reason I tell these stories, is the stories which it doesn't work, I don't usually tell people. The ones where it does, of course you tell people, it's inspiring. And in Sydney, about 6 months, 9 months later, could be a year, I don't know, and this guy comes up to me and says that terrible word, "Do you remember me?" And, you know, I had good reason not to remember him, because if you see someone who's, you know, really at the last stages of cancer, they look just so thin and gaunt, and their life's energy is almost gone. And this was a really fit, filled out, happy, radiant young man, middle-aged man. And he said, "That was me." He said, "I carried on, you know, what you taught me." And just, you know, it popped many times until it stayed open. And now that tumour, you know, went into recession, and then tumour's gone. I'm clean bill of health. And you know, when people actually say those things to you, you feel just, wow, this is amazing that somehow or other you were responsible or partly responsible for saving a person's life. I mean, really big time. And then afterwards, you know, he said there's something which we call pay it forward. So don't thank me. He said, "You know, your job is to go out and just, you know, what helped you, what worked for you, go and teach somebody else." He said, "Yeah, that's what I'm doing." Dedicated the rest of his life, however many years he has, to teach other people. Now how to actually to use this mind to shrink tumours or all this other stuff which is possible. So it's amazing what this mind can do. So actually, when you are meditating, when you get this mind to be happy, joyful when you're meditating, I can watch the breath go in and go out. It's just like being with an old friend. I can cuddle this teddy bear for hours. Because it's soft, not threatening. It's kind, it's peaceful, it's pleasant, it's delightful. So if you can do that with your breath, breathing in, breathing out, nothing else to do in the whole world except just watching one breath go in and go out. What could be more restful, more relaxing, more peaceful? And what that means is, after a while, just the mind just locks onto your breathing. And it becomes the delightful breath. When it gets delightful, because you're staying there, you're not moving, no effort, no struggle, you find the peace deepens and the delight strengthens. Which is why that sometimes you see people meditating with this beautiful smile on their face. And you think, they must be fantasizing or something. No, they're not. They're just enjoying, just watching a breath. And you think, how crazy can this be? You can sort of listen to Beethoven's Fifth. You can just watch a sunset. You can go and watch Niagara Falls. So I was in Toronto, and PLN said, "I had a free day. Do you want to go see Niagara Falls?" I said, "No way. I just want to stay in my room and watch my breath." It's much more delightful than Niagara Falls. Am I a crazy monk? Or am I onto something important? I think I'm onto something important. I'd rather watch, it's only about 100 kilometres away, 100 miles away, no, kilometres in Canada. But I'd rather just sit in the room and just watch the breath go in. Oh, this is nice, breath go out. So beautiful. So that's what we do, we meditate. So how do we meditate? So simple, just watch your breath. So I'll now give you practical details on how to meditate. Don't need to change your posture, how you're sitting now is fine. When I say go, I want you to close your eyes and watch three breaths, in, out, in, out, in, out. You don't need to change, it's only just three breaths, that's not that long. Okay, ready, steady, go. Just three breaths, in, out, in, out, in, out. After the third breath, open your eyes. Was that hard? And how did you watch your breath? How did you know the breath was going in? How did you know it was going out? And some teachers say, oh, you should watch the tip of your nose. Sometimes say just the left nostril, just the right nostril. In the right nostril, out the left nostril. Whatever, that's just, to me that's crazy. Keep it easy, natural. You knew the breath was going in, going out. Could not have, maybe not even in your nostrils. Doesn't matter where the breath is going in and going out. As long as you know it's going in or it's going out. Just be with it. Give it respect and gratitude and value. Keep it natural. You don't force it. You are the passenger, the observer. Because you know your body does the breathing. It does the breathing much better than you can ever do it. So just let the body breathe. And you just watch it. Breathing in, breathing out. And after a while you get so peaceful. And as you get peaceful, you get delightful. When the breath becomes delightful, you enjoy watching the breath. It's easy, it's peaceful, it's nice. When that delight comes up, don't chase it away. Don't think I'm enjoying meditation and religion. Whoa, you shouldn't enjoy religion. Otherwise you'll get attached. So silly that meditation is supposed to be full of joy. Even the story in the suttas by the Buddha. This king went to visit the Buddha and he said, I always love coming to this monastery to visit you. Why do you like coming to this monastery? There's other monasteries around. And the king said, because in this monastery, this is the Monuments of the Dhamma Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. In this monastery, whenever I come in here, the monks are always happy and smiling. And he said, and the Buddha said, yes, exactly, that's how it should be when people are meditating properly and getting insights. It creates happiness in you. So that's why I can tell who's got the really good meditations. You can't fake it. You can't just sit here. Just, I'm a great meditator, if you sit here for 2 hours without moving. As I said yesterday, that's chicken meditation. But you look how happy people's features are. If they're smiling. Yeah, you're meditating. Peace, joy, freedom, just being here. How much happier can you get? Actually, quite a lot more, but this is a good start. So you're enjoying breathing in, breathing out, in, out. And of course, later on we have these meditation, walking meditation rooms. One over there, one over there, one over there, and anywhere else in the compound you want to do some walking meditation. And there also, they fit in with the sitting meditation. You start at the very beginning of the, you can see I always mention this point, red carpets. That's how important we think walking meditation is. We give you red carpets. Well, actually they're yoga mats, and some are not really red, they're more like orange, but it's all they had in the shop when we got close enough. But so you start on one end, and then you just walk naturally. Do you know how to walk? Well, you just walk. Start from the beginning, go to the end. But just be mindful of your steps. So you're left, right, left, right, left, right. Just enjoy it. You don't need to sort of beat the Guinness World Records of the slowest walker, which happens sometimes in some retreats. I never did this myself. Sometimes, you know, when I was a lay person, you'd have be walking next to somebody else, and that lady, she was so slow when she was walking meditation. So I thought, I can beat that. So stupid competition about who would actually reach the wall last, not first. It's amazing just how the ego and the conceit can get in there somewhere. But I can't resist the story of one of the retreats over here. It wasn't my retreat, thank goodness. People were doing this very slow walking meditation. I mean, really slow. And they did it all at the same time, together. You know, out there in the, it's a nice sunny day, in the car park. And we had a couple of visitors. This Sri Lankan couple and their young son, 7-8 years of age, came. And immediately he insisted that his parents take him straight back to Bodhinyana Monastery where I still was receiving guests. And he came up, he was really distraught, he was really scared. Ajahn Brahm, you've got to go to your retreat centre now. He was really upset. So what's wrong? He said, zombies. The zombies have invaded your meditation centre. Because that apparently lots of movies about zombies. The Walking Dead. And that's what the walking meditators look like to a 7 or 8 year old boy. So you can walk fast, walk slow, it doesn't really matter, it's just as long as you're here with the walking. You're just being a natural observer, just like you're observing the breath, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. You're watching your feet, left, right, left, right. And just as with the breath, as you get more relaxed, more mindful, you start to see from the very beginning of an in-breath, when it starts, and the very end of an out-breath, not an in-breath, the beginning of an out-breath, the end of the out-breath, you sit right, the whole movement of the breath, the whole movement of the breath as it goes out. It becomes fascinating. The movement of your feet, the right foot, as it moves off the ground, does it go straight up? Of course it doesn't. Mine, the one usually goes back a bit, and then it arcs forward, and then it comes down again. How does your foot move through space as you walk? What is the first part of your foot which separates from the floor? Is it the toe, the ball of the foot, the heel of the foot, the instep? What's the last part? What's the first part which meets the ground at the end of a step? Don't think about it. Experience it. And you can feel the pressure of your foot on the floor as one step has been completed. And surprise, surprise, you can really get a lot of joy and happiness out of that. Surprising. Why? It's because it's a simple activity. It's very peaceful. It takes all your attention. And if you don't mind the cold so much, take off your socks so you can just feel the floor and its textures on your skin. You become alive, real, in this moment. And soon the walking meditation. For some people, they prefer that to sitting meditation. But at the very least, we balance sitting meditation, walking meditation, doing it together, which is the best. So that's the little talk this morning about not wanting anything. Learning how to be peaceful. Being here. And just as you are sitting down meditating, you just watch the breath go in, go out. You don't force it. Become a friend to it, such a close friend that you're almost inseparable. And then the breath becomes so easy to watch. Watch it with a little bit more interest and value. This breath is important to you. It's been so good to you. And then see the breath from the very beginning to its end. It's not just in or out. It's a whole movement of many, 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 many different sensations. Find out the space between the end of an in-breath and the beginning of an out-breath. Or the space between the end of the out-breath and the beginning of the in-breath. Which is longer? And then you do your walking meditation. You feel the steps, the feet move up through the air till they go forward and then take the weight of your body so the other foot can move. This whole process is simple. And when you're doing walking meditation, by the way, keep your eyes open, but just look a body length in front of you at the floor. Don't look to the left or the right, up or down, just a body length in front of you. Just so if you get very peaceful, you know, you don't, honestly, they don't hit the wall. Because suddenly you get so inside of your mind and enjoying yourself, you don't know where you are. So just keeping the mind, the eyes open, the body length means you don't step on anything or hit yourself. Just basic stuff, and then turn around and come back again, enjoying the nice peaceful walking. And then we can see where we go next. And if you find yourself a little hard, not enough kindness, get a teddy bear and cuddle it when you're meditating. It's amazing. People think this is Ajahn Brahm. You know, I'm serious. Exactly. If you're serious, you're the one who needs a teddy bear. Very good. Okay, so that's enough for now. I'm doing some interviews now. So happy meditation this morning. And if you want to take a nap, you're still welcome to take a nap, to relax, have a cup of tea, watch the trees grow, go for a walk, have a shower. Is there anything to, any announcements? Okay. And just have a lovely day.